A normal town council member says she would like to use some of the town share of federal pandemic relief money to lower fares for people with disabilities who use Connect Transit. And Karen Smith says relief for those behind on water and sewer payments might also make her priority list. That story just ahead on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A Bloomington Normal cybersecurity expert says the pandemic and social upheaval has made people more vulnerable to attempts to compromise their computers because it puts noise in the system.
You just get into the sense of reacting in the moment, and you're not doing the checks and balances that you would normally do.
Cyber criminals also often target people who work from home. Plus, a Central Illinois author answers the question, what's in a nickname? A college mascot nickname. Those stories and a Bloomington Normal News update just ahead. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal is collecting public feedback on how to spend $10.8 million in federal pandemic relief money. There's an online survey up for about 6 weeks to have people rank their choices. Town Council member Karen Smith says she hopes people take the survey and are thoughtful about it. Smith says the feds do have rules on how to spend the money.
As specified through the American Rescue Plan Act itself, the eligible uses are to support public health expenditures, address negative economic impact caused by the pandemic, replace lost public sector revenue, that is what the town suffered because of reduced business activity and reduced sales collection, tax collections, provide premium pay for essential workers, and invest in water, sewer, and broadband infrastructure. What is specifically prohibited are things like directly or indirectly offsetting tax reductions or tax spending. So it can't be used to provide a tax cut to citizens. It cannot be used to fund pensions, debt service, and legal settlements or adjustments.
So engaging public sentiment on how to portion this out and which buckets to put the funding into, an online survey may or may not be all that useful. How can you make it useful and representative? How is the town trying to do that?
For one thing, it's using multiple avenues to solicit the information. The Facebook page for the Town of Normal has a link for the survey. The town's own website has a prominent link when you access that site. The town has listservs of email addresses, and they'll be sending out to individuals that way. In an effort to determine that it is a broad cross-section, the survey does request some demographic information, and it is going to ask for zip code so that we can prioritize responses from Normal residents.
We're at the start of the process right now, but surely you have some sense of your own priorities. What might those be?
The first thing that came to mind was, for me, the Town of Normal honoring the request from the Connect Transit Working Group to increase the town's funding by $100,000. One of their driving motivations was to address the fare structure, because initially when Connect Transit was seeking to offset the financial challenges they were having, fare increases were disproportionately assessed against the disabled. And in the working group, there were representatives of that community, advocates for that community, and they looked at both a no-fare system, a permanent no-fare system, or a one-fare system. And they felt that if the towns, both Bloomington and Normal, would increase their funding, it would enable them to support one fare for both mobility riders and regular Connect Transit. And so I feel that it's incumbent upon the Town of Normal to make it possible for that to be an ongoing program, because it doesn't just support Connect Transit, but those increased dollars free up more matching dollars from the state.
Well, the American Rescue Plan would get that off the ground, but how would the town sustain it? How would it, what's the what would have to give way in the out years after the American Rescue Plan money is already done?
Well, I believe it was your station this morning reported Rivian has achieved the 3,000 employee mark, high water marks to date, making them the third largest employer in our area. That will bring in new citizens. The council has had multiple subdivision plots come before us that had lain dormant for a number of years, and now we've got new building, new construction, new residents coming in. I have confidence that the growth that we are seeing can support that $100,000 going forward.
The town has recently begun to talk about the need to get people into a payment plan because the utility shutoff moratorium from the pandemic should expire fairly soon. Not everybody is going to be able to or be in the right headspace to make arrangements. What's going to happen? What do you think should happen?
Well, the first thing that I'm hoping everyone does who receives a notice from the town is that they'll contact town staff and discuss what their options are. There are several opportunities for those who qualify because of their income levels to possibly get aid to assist with that. And there's for those who don't currently qualify for that financial assistance or subsidy towards their outstanding billing, that the town is more than willing to arrange a payment plan that would be agreeable and workable for both parties. Also, on the subject of the survey and the American Rescue Plan, one of the options would be, as I mentioned, for revenue offsets, so that if citizens specify that they are in favor of having some the town themselves provide some support, that would be a new program. That is an acceptable use of these ARPA dollars. That would open up yet a third avenue of financial support. The important thing is that individuals respond and take action. I know from dealing with individuals in making financial decisions and dealing with students, it's all too easy to bury your head in the sand and hope it goes away. It doesn't. And the best thing you can do is to take action and communicate and find a solution that is agreeable to both sides.
The amount that's delinquent is not insignificant. How much of the American Rescue Plan funds do you think should be apportioned to it? You only have, you know, $5-plus million this year and another $5-plus million next year.
I think for those who need it, the funds should be apportioned to help them. They had something like 19% respond and pay in full after only one notice. Mm-hmm. Since then, some other parties have paid theirs in full. So as of yesterday, when I was checking my email, the number of accounts is down to 985. If someone has lost a job or could not work because of concerns about their family's health, their children's well-being, the responsibilities of caring for children who were at home and needing to play a parent, teacher, and worker, that was overwhelming. And for some individuals, it was just too much. And so if the utility program provides some relief for those individuals, then I think it is appropriate to provide those options after we look at what other programs have been exhausted.
Karen Smith is a member of the Normal Town Council. The town has half of its $10.8 million American Rescue Plan money in hand, and the other half will come next year. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A cybersecurity expert says COVID-19 has made our workplaces less safe from online viruses. Dan Taube is the interim chief information security officer at Illinois State University. He tells Eric Stock businesses, schools, banks, and others who had large numbers of people working from home are especially vulnerable.
It's not only just The devices that they're using may not have the protections installed on the devices, but the detection of an event or an incident that we may see on our own network goes unnoticed. And so maybe they did get malware or a virus on their computer, or their password was compromised because of a phishing attack. Since they're working away from the organization, our tools that monitor the network don't see that activity. And so during the pandemic, the attackers know this, and they shifted a little bit to be the volume of attacks increased, as well as the methods that they did to target remote individuals. Now, added to that was they used what we saw in the legitimate space as some of their scams. So they would say, click this or respond to this to get your financial benefits or your unemployment insurance or your you know, sign up early for the vaccine. They use those as well because of the pandemic and were very effective with it.
Did it make us easier targets because of this? In our desperate search sometimes for the right information?
I think so. In research that's been done about why even trained individuals fall for social engineering attacks, it's usually because of distractions or too much going on. And I think with the pandemic and everything else going on in general society, it created a lot of noise that whenever something seemed urgent or important, you just get into the sense of reacting in the moment, and you're not doing the checks and balances that you would normally do when everything's calm and comfortable. And I think that's a product of the pandemic and what we've been going through.
Any examples that you can speak to in your work experience where those distractions have built up and have caused someone to take their eye off the ball, so to speak?
Yes, I can share one in particular for myself where luckily I thought about it and considered it and caught myself, but we had a few incidents of security events that required all hands on deck. It's the entire team responding, bringing in other individuals, analyzing a lot of information. And during one of those events in particular, as I'm focused on everything going on, many communication channels, different audiences to speak with, I received a phone call. And that phone call I associated with the event and being legitimate, because they said just the right type of things to get my mind in this distracted state to think it was related. And it was just one thing they said that led me to pause for a moment, ask a question of them, and realize, no, this is unrelated and happened to be someone trying to compromise me individually.
How safe is Illinois State University from being hacked?
That's an interesting question. If someone were to ask if we are secure, I would be hesitant to say yes, but I would assert that we're always working towards being secure. It's a continual effort type of thing. Now, over the past year alone, we've done a lot of projects to specifically address threats that a university or higher education in general faces. We are better now than we've ever been, just out of a sheer need to do it with the pandemic and everyone being away from campus and having less chance to educate them, but also because we see the attempts to compromise us. We experience it every so often that it's more than just phishing. It's someone that's trying to get into our environment, and that will be a constant battle. Now, there's one specific challenge we face as a university, and anyone in education will share this. We can't be too restrictive. We need to enable the core mission of the institution to teach and conduct research and communicate across the board, where we're limited in exactly what we can do.
That was Dan Taube from ISU's Information Security with Eric Stock. Taube says consumers are generally lax about protecting their online data. He says they shouldn't use the same password for multiple accounts. He recommends using a password manager that can store passwords and generate secure passwords. He says scammers have also gotten better at disguising phishing attempts to look legitimate.
This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. I'm R.C. McBride along with Melissa Leibert, and we're interrupting Sound Ideas today because we're in the final hours of Fall Fun Drive, and we are way behind where we need to be to pay for your favorite NPR programs and to fully fund the WGLT newsroom.
We've been at this fun drive for a week now. Maybe you forgot or you haven't had time to contribute yet. We understand. It's time to step up now, though. Please don't wait. Come through in the final hours with your contribution in any amount at WGLT.org.
It is super quick and easy to give on our website. You can give $120 for the year, or you can give $10 a month. They're actually the same thing, but you could do it once or 12 different times. It's totally up to you. And whatever works for you is perfect for us. The most important decision that you can make right now is to give, because without listener support, we can't deliver all the news and programming that this community wants and deserves.
If you've been listening for the last week, though, and we still haven't convinced you, here are a few more reasons to support NPR and WGLT according to our donors, like high-quality local news coverage,
NPR programming,
fact-based journalism,
and our coverage of local music.
And Sound Ideas, of course, why you're listening right now. This news program is the only one of its kind in this community. WGLT brings you the stories and interviews with newsmakers you will not hear. We promise you won't hear them anywhere else.
Whatever your reason is for tuning into NPR and WGLT, we do thank you. But please know that this service can only continue with more listener financial support. During this Fun Drive's final hours, we need more of you to step up and donate. Give $550 or $5 a month. Whatever works for your budget, again, works just fine for us. The most important decision that you can make right now is to go ahead and give at WGLT.org.
Donors tell us all the time. One of the many things they love about WGLT is that we're different from other local media outlets. One way we're different is shows like Sound Ideas. We're only able to bring you this show each weekday full of local news because we're investing more, not less, in reporting stories about Bloomington Normal.
That level of coverage means that we can report on both District 87 and Unit 5, and we can interview the mayor of Normal and the mayor of Bloomington. We can report on changes at State Farm and at Rivian. We can eat our green eggs and a ham in a box and with a fox. Our community deserves this level of dedicated news coverage. When you turn on Sound Ideas, you'll never hear rumors or misinformation or even opinions. What you will hear is thoughtful conversations, well-researched stories, and fact-based journalism.
Show us that level of journalism matters in your life and to this community. Financially support our ongoing commitment to the stories and newsmakers you care about. Donate at WGLT.org to fully fund this fun drive and your local newsroom.
Right now, the WGLT newsroom is growing. A lot of other media outlets, unfortunately, are shrinking. We want to keep the growth going. As a nonprofit media organization, every dollar we raise is invested right back into the operation. So now it's your turn to invest in us, renew your support, or make your first ever contribution at WGLT.org.
We're in the final hours of this fall fund drive, and we need more donors to step up with their financial support for community-powered and community-focused media.
Here are a few ways every listener can help right now in the final hours of Fun Drive. You can renew your annual gift. You can increase your monthly donation. You can make an additional gift. Or you can step up with your first donation ever to NPR and WGLT. If you've already given, share your reason for supporting WGLT with your friends or on social media and ask someone else to step forward with their financial support.
Every single listener dollar is invested right back into this station to fund your favorite programs and a local newsroom. Right now, we haven't raised enough money to fund this level of service that we're currently delivering. That's why we're here. That's why we're still asking for your support.
So please, give now at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A lifetime fascination has resulted in a new book by a Central Illinois author. Chris Pyle from Galesburg has just published Griffins, Gorlocks, and Gusties, a history of the NCAA Division III nicknames and mascots. Herb Trix has more.
Chris Pyle says his fascination started while he was coaching track and cross country at Monmouth College and working as sports information director in the 1980s and 90s.
It was just one of those subjects that I was passionate about as a lifelong sports fan. I've always been fascinated by sports history and trivia, facts and figures, and it was just something that I was interested in. I didn't know if there was anybody out there that cared about it as much as I did, but it was just something personally fascinating. I thought it was a story worth telling.
His book includes 450 stories, 439 currently active D3 schools, and 11 more that have either closed or consolidated since he began writing.
You would think if it was an animal, if it was an eagle or a hawk or a lion or a tiger, it would just be because of the animal and the characteristics. But oftentimes, there were really uncommon backstories.
One of his favorites is the Jumbos.
The best animal example that I can use that comes to mind is an elephant. The Jumbos of Tufts University out in Medford, Massachusetts, they are the Jumbos because one of the original trustees of the university was P.T. Barnum. And P.T. Barnum had the show animal, the prize elephant, Jumbo. So Jumbo not only became the mascot and the nickname of Tufts University, but became a word in the English language that had never existed before.
He chose the three names in the title of his book because they're unique among small colleges in the U.S. and for the alliteration, Griffins, Gorlocks, and Gusties.
Griffin is a mythological character. It's a creature with the head and the wings of an eagle and the feet and the body of a lion. So the griffin embodies the king of the sky and the king of the land. So it had some legendary properties. It's always seen as the guardian of treasure. Gorlock was a fictional creature that was made up by the student body of Webster University in St. Louis. Webster is located in Webster Grove, which is a suburb of St. Louis, and two streets that intersect near the heart of the campus, Gore Avenue and Lockwood Avenue. Gorlock. It's a compound word that they just made up. They created this fictional creature that, just like the griffin, is a combination of animals, part cheetah, part buffalo, part St. Bernard.
And Gusties comes from the name of Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. Many names come from the founders of each college, whether it be Vikings, Fighting Scots, or the Norse.
There are 17 schools that have some version of hawks as their nickname: Warhawks, Riverhawks, Dewhawks, Cohawks. But the reason why they are called that is not the same from one school to the next. So it's been really fascinating to find out the subtle differences, because a lot of it ties back into the school's history or some event.
Bowdoin College in Maine is the Polar Bears because one of its graduates discovered the North Pole.
I've just kind of touched on the tip of it with Division III schools, because that's where I've spent the bulk of my professional life over the last 40 years has been in Division III. It's as much a sports book as it is a history book.
Next, Pyle plans to write a similar book about Division II colleges and their nicknames, and then go on to Division I. I'm Herb Trix.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.